The following is Darrell Rabinowitz and Mike Lefkowitz's talk, Integrating UX and Agile, Designer and Scrum Master Perspectives from the 2012 Information Architecture Summit. The 2012 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by User Interface Engineering and the UIE Virtual Seminar Program. Stay tuned after the podcast for a special offer from UIE.
Okay, I guess we're going to get started. Thanks for coming. I'm Darrell Rabinowitz. I'm a designer.
And I'm Mike Lefkowitz. I'm a software engineer and a Scrum Master.
We're talking about how we work together on a whole bunch of different Agile teams. But we'd like to know a little bit about you guys first, to start off the day. Can the audience stand up if you're left-handed? So it's not quite half. Okay, so now, if you had superpowers, would you rather be invisible or would you rather fly? Stand up if you'd rather be invisible. Most people would rather fly.
Is your only power the ability to fly?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, so you never
heard 500
miles
an hour. Stand up if you work in-house. Sit down if you work outhouse. Outhouse?
Outhouse. Like it.
Oh.
Wow.
Okay. That's very telling.
Yeah. All right, so how many people think you know what Agile is? If you do, yeah, raise your hand. That's fine. I won't make you stand up. All right, now how many of you think that your definition of Agile is the same as your neighbor's? Agile is actually not iterations. It's not doing things in sprints or iterations. You can be doing things in iterations and not be agile. It's not a set of best practices. So things like paired programming and things of that nature, that doesn't make you agile. You can do those things. They're great, but that's not agile. It's not actually a stinking process. A lot of people think Agile is a process. Scrum is a process, but Agile is actually not. And it's not an adjective. It's not about being nimble. It's not a game of dodgeball. Just because you're changing things all the time doesn't make you Agile. So what Agile is, it's a huge mindset shift. It's a mindset based on four values and 12 principles. It encompasses a number of different processes, like Scrum being the most popular one, but there are a number of them, and lots of practices as well. But it's fundamentally a mindset. And if you want to read about the four values and 12 principles, the URL there is agilemanifesto.org. On a scale of 1 to 5, where 5 is love Agile and 1 is hate Agile, how many would say you're a 5? A few. Okay. 4? Yeah, a few more. 3? That's most people. 2? 1? Nobody hates it? Wow, that's a friendly room. Okay, so everybody's neutral. We have a fertile field to work with, Darrell. So what do you think of when you think of Agile? Do you think of, you know, I'd rather run a marathon than do Agile? Or, you know, Agile doesn't let me do my best work because I'm having to constantly do stuff within these little short iterations. Is it scary to you?
When I first heard about Agile, this is what I thought. And I think a lot of designers, user experience, information architects are kind of intimidated by Agile. At least I was when I began. And it says up there, it says, Agile equals pain. Nope, well, sometimes, but it's worth it. It really is. It may be hard, but I think it's worth it because Agile's made me a better designer. And I'm going to back that up. So first I was going to define what being a better designer is. And I think that there's your core skills, like, okay, I'm really, really good at what I do, and I explore multiple solutions, and I'm really good at explaining my design rationale, and I probably have T-shaped skills where I'm deep in one area and broad across. And then there's my soft skills, you know, I ask a lot of questions, and I have a lot of empathy. I may be really good at negotiation and communication, but there's that special sauce that makes a better designer, and it's really a little bit undefined. And by the way, I'm just using designer because that's what I call myself. But if you're an information architect or you're a user experience person, whatever you are, I think Agile will make you better at it. So my first time on an Agile team, or my first time working with Mike's Agile team, the team actually had a freelancer working with them originally, and the engineers were not really happy with user experience folks.
That was an understatement.
And I walked in to their first retrospective, and all they did was complain about not being involved in the design and not having a voice in the design and being thrown things over the wall and saying, that's not Agile. And so my immediate reaction was, okay, I'm going to overshare. So I showed them sketches right away that weren't baked, and I asked for their opinion. And I basically embedded myself on the team, and I went to the daily stand-ups, and I listened to what they were doing, and so I could ask them questions. And they talked to me about what they were doing. And it began to have like a healthy respect for each other's work. We really started listening and talking to each other. And it was step one.
In my first time working on an Agile team with an experienced designer, we were working on a project, it was at Intuit, but we were working on a project that was very much like a startup. It was very blue sky. We literally had a two-sentence description of the product we were going to go out and build. We didn't really know a lot about it. It was a lot of fun, as those kind of things usually are, but for our poor designer, it was really a bit of a nightmare because starting from zero, you know, we were ready to start writing code and she didn't have designs ready. And so, you know, she was constantly trying to play catch up, and it was really hard for her. Maybe you can kind of relate to that. But one of the things that she did that was a tremendous gift to us was she gave us, I think it was about 8 or 9 hours of her time to teach us just some basic design stuff, stuff that is so ingrained in you that you don't even think about, things like fonts and use of white space and how to arrange things on the screen based on how the eye scans the page and just all these principles. And what that allowed us to do was, you know, as engineers, we could do the basic stuff without having to have a lot of design done for us because we understood, you know, what we were trying to achieve. And that freed her up to be able to spend her time on the harder things, the more difficult things. So we would implement something, and then she could look at it and give us 5 or 10 minutes and say, you know, move this over here, make this a little bigger, make that red, whatever. And it really helped a lot, just having that little bit of training to equip us. So it was all about getting us on the same page. I'm sorry you can't read that very well, but the quote says, Scrum doesn't solve any problems, it just exposes them. That's a quote from a guy named Mike Cohn, who's one of the gods of Agile, especially of Scrum. There's a lot of dysfunctions that we see on teams, and regardless of whether they're doing Agile or not. Things like passive-aggressive behaviors, things like low-level personality conflicts that, you know, pop up every once in a while, but they're kind of hard to see if you just kind of jump on the team and just talk to people. A lack of quality practices where people are writing crappy code, nobody is inspecting it, so you're constantly fighting bugs and fixing bugs. Siloed thinking is a really big one. You know, this is my area of the product. I work on this. I don't work on that stuff. I just work on this. And this is mine. You leave it alone. Or, you know, I'm an engineer. I don't test. QA people test. Or maybe I'm a designer. I don't test. I don't know. A lack of initiative, and this is probably a big one for you folks, is, you know, I can't get started until somebody tells me what to do. I can't start working on this screen until you give me a finished design. And that's just complete nonsense. I mean, there's a lot of things that engineers can do before they have a final design. Another is uneven workloads or team members that aren't pulling their weight on the team. And all these dysfunctions on a traditional team may kind of go unnoticed because people aren't really collaborating that tightly. You know, people have a list of things. This is my task list, and I go off and do my tasks. But in Agile, all that stuff is transparent and revealed, and you're going to know right away if you've got dysfunctions on the team. It's not going to fix those dysfunctions for you, but at least you're going to know about them.
And in my case, I had to overcome their past experience that was bad. And so I know they started out wanting to like me, but they had this immediate prejudice, like, oh, the designer is going to hold me up, or the designer is not going to listen to me. And all I could do was try to communicate with them and be available for them and show them my work. I really did overshare. I mean, I sent them hand sketches all the time and just described stuff. And it was basically about earning their trust. So it ends up being all about the team, right? You have to get in with the team. And for me, what started being really good was being embedded. It says lean into your team and be really embedded and becoming one of the team so that it's not them and me, it's us. And it's all about that face-to-face interaction and communicating with them. And, you know, really for me, being comfortable talking to engineers about design. And that's why it made me a better designer, because I was part of the team and I had to talk about it all the time. In the beginning, especially, Agile really helped me develop those soft skills that are the difference between being a good designer and a better one, with all that face-to-face communication. And the other thing about Agile, as Mike said, is that you pitch in, right? We're not talking about silos. So I was the interaction designer, but I also, when in a pinch, would clean up a piece of graphic, or I made icons, and I sat down and made some CSS, and, you know, I just helped them do stuff. So I really played multiple roles and tasks. And also, you really have to learn how to focus. There's a lot of different things going on. A lot of people are asking you questions. You know, for me, I would go to a scrum and somebody would say, I'm working on this, can you check it out? And I'd have to jump into that mind space. And then somebody else would say, but I need a graphic and I really need it fast. So I'd have to jump into that mind space. So I really feel like you have to test your skills.
So one of the things that we did to kind of address some of these challenges that we faced as a team was we put into place what we called pre-planning meetings. It's interesting, I was just reading an article yesterday, this is becoming kind of an industry-wide practice now. People sometimes call them backlog grooming meetings, where you get together a few days or a week before iteration planning, and you sit down for a half hour or an hour, and you go through the requirements and the designs in whatever form they're in at that point in time. They may not be finished, but you kind of go through and you talk through them. And that gives the whole team an opportunity to ask questions, to say, okay, well, what about this case and that case? And you can have those conversations before you get into the planning meeting. And it gives everyone time to take that feedback and think about it and incorporate it before you actually get into the iteration planning. And the math is a little weird about that, because you can take a team that takes 8 hours to do their planning meeting, and you can invest just an hour in a pre-planning meeting and cut that down to 2 or 3 hours to do planning, because you're coming into planning already knowing what it is you're going to do, and there's not really a lot of questions. It's just a matter of putting together some estimates and doing a commitment.
I mean, one of the reasons we came up with this pre-planning meeting was I started showing them designs, right? I said I'm oversharing, but nobody's getting back to me. Everybody's really too busy to look at everything. And so all of a sudden it's planning and everybody's jumping on, what are we building? Let me look at your flows, let me look at your wires. And by the way, this doesn't work, or this is going to be really hard and this is going to take a long time and I want you to change this. And it was really impossible for me at that first meeting to really respond to everybody's feedback. And of course, they wanted me to come up with a new solution right then. So I went to Mike and said, dude, we have to fix this. And we did.
We did. It works great.
So one of the important things to do in Agile is make the process serve you. Make it your own. It's not necessarily you have to do what the team's been doing before. Make it help you do what you need to do.
One of the things that I do at Intuit is I teach Agile classes. And one of the things that we talk about on those Agile classes is how a designer's time should be allocated, how it should be used. And the reason is because we've seen over and over again, if you don't have some kind of a set expectation, not only among designers, but among the rest of the team about how the designer is going to be working, then what you wind up with is people are making all these demands, you know, 2 days before iteration planning. they need all this stuff, and the designer winds up spending all of his or her time working on the current iterations stuff. And so what we tell people is, you know, to split your time along 20%, 20%, and 60%, where 20% is working in the current iteration, doing things like getting visual assets and making tweaks to the workflows and dealing with any discovered requirements that we didn't know about before. And then another 20% working on the next iteration's work and doing things like tuning the workflows and the interactions, creating the final visual design, finishing up the wireframes, things like that. But the bulk of the time should really be spent working two iterations out, doing the user research, doing the elaboration of requirements so we understand, you know, everything that is involved in doing the work, and creating the wireframes at that point.
However, my reality is often really different. And it really, really depends on what we're building and when we're building it. And I made these numbers 30% for the current iteration, 50% for the upcoming, and 20% for the future. That's where I am this week. But some weeks it's 100% on the current iteration because we're making all sorts of changes. And some weeks I actually get to be strategic and think ahead. It really depends. There's a huge amount of flexibility that I need to have in thinking about how to do my work. And I know that there are some people that don't actually work iterations ahead, but this is what we found works for us. And it made me a better designer, okay? Because first of all, I had to speak up for what wasn't working. I really had to not just go with the flow, but try to make changes and have a strong voice. And as we just spoke about, I have to be really, really adaptable, right? I have to figure out what's working and where my time should go and switch my focus. And I really need to experiment with different methods. You know, at first I was posting my designs on a website where they could click through them and look at them. And nobody could find it. Nobody could remember the URL. So I made a wiki, and we could keep our notes on the wiki so that it wasn't back and forth in an email. You know, I just really had to play around with what's going to work best for the team. And so now, okay, I'm embedded in the team. People trust me. I'm sharing my work. We've changed the process so that people can get involved and see my work. And now I actually have to incorporate design feedback from the engineers. And this is really interesting because I feel like we had to figure out exactly how to talk to each other. And the engineers in the past had been given a lot of emails that were very, very concentrating on a lot of visual designs, like change this one pixel and this font is wrong. And they weren't really appreciating that email back and forth critique, the old-fashioned way of doing things. One of the things that I did that actually really worked well was I just sat down with one of the software engineers and said, you know, I'm not sure that this looks right. I'm not exactly sure how I want to change it. Can we just play with it right now on your computer? And we sat down together, and together we changed some sizes and colors. And he was so pleased that I asked him his opinion and that it was just in person and then it was done. And so what ended up happening is that every day after our stand-up, engineers would say, hey, can you just look at this and we'll tweak it? And can you look at this? And there would be like a little line of, you know, get Darrell's eyes on something. And all of a sudden now, we're having a dialogue, we're making changes together, and it's not some big hard thing. It's more like, okay, I thought this would work, let's try it.
One of the things that I think causes sometimes a bit of an impedance mismatch between designers and engineers is engineers are not typically the greatest communicators. I don't know if you ever noticed that. But, you know, sometimes we come across the wrong way and we don't really mean to. So I want to kind of run through just a little bit of, you know, what's the personality of an engineer and, you know, what kind of drives us in the way that we work together. So it says up at the top, engineers are problem solvers. And so because we're problem solvers, we're very analytical. And so we're not really so much into, you know, the soft skills. You know, we're really more into facts. Tell me why. One of the things that has not gone over well on teams I've been on is where a designer takes the approach of, well, it needs to be this way because I said so, or You know, I'm the designer, and this is the way it's supposed to be because I'm the designer. Because engineers really just want to know why. You know, all you have to say is, well, the eye scans like this, and so we want to put the most important thing over here. And engineers go, oh, okay, that makes sense now that I understand why. Engineers are strategic thinkers. I don't know if strategic thinkers is really the right word, but I couldn't think of a good way to describe the fact that engineers like to look ahead. They like to know what's coming. And so being able to see two or three iterations down the road helps a lot with them knowing how to approach a given problem in implementing. Because if we know, for example, we're going to build this thing, this iteration, next iteration we're going to add on to it these next few things, and the iteration after that we're going to continue to build on it, build out some more things, that the way we approach implementing that is going to be different from, you know, okay, we're going to implement this thing and then we're going to go on to other things and maybe we'll come back to it, maybe we won't. Very different approach. So for them to be able to look ahead and see, you know, what's coming is very, very helpful. Engineers are optimists, and if you don't believe it, just show them something cool and ask them how long it'll take to get it done. We will say or do anything to work on something cool. And so just be prepared for the fact that, you know, if you're going to show them something cool, they're going to want to be all over it. And then finally, engineers like consistency. One of the mantras of software development is reuse. And so if you have one part of the application that asks for name, address, and phone number, and another part of the application that asks for name and address and phone number, it's really great for us if those two things are able to be actually the same widget that asks for a name, address, and phone number. And so that consistency is really important for engineers because then we get to reuse things and that makes us happy. And we want happy engineers.
We totally want happy engineers. So for me, as the designer, I have to kind of get over the us and them mentality, right? A good idea is a good idea, and it doesn't matter where it comes from. It's up to me to take that idea and make it work, and maybe I'll do it with the help of the engineers. But engineers think of stuff I don't think of, right? And we all own the experience. The product is the experience. We all have the same goal. Like this, it's my thing, don't touch it. Don't do that. So it's made me a better designer because I have to listen to engineers and communicate with them, and we don't always speak the same language. Agile really helped me hear what other people were saying. I'm no longer working in a design bubble. I'm no longer only getting critiques from my user experience team. You know, I really need to work closely with the developers to help me understand the possibilities and limitations, to help me design that system that can be reused as opposed to this really cool page or this really cool interaction. And I think it's actually harder to design within limitations than without. So, you know, their point of view and their way of working and communicating, it's different than mine. That stretches me. You know, it makes me work outside of my comfort zone. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, if you're doing something different on a daily basis, you know, maybe you'll come up with something different as opposed to the same old, same old. So, once we started working closely together, the team, we were actually really able to change things rapidly. One of the things we really like about iterations is that, you know, there's only so much work you can do in this small amount of time, so you really can't screw things up that badly in a couple of weeks. And it's kind of freeing, right? It helps me think about the solution that I can do right now, but I don't always have to have all the right answers. Meanwhile, I'm asking everybody for their opinion, I'm asking for help, and they have some expertise that I may not have, and because they're telling me, well, if we could reuse this in a certain way, it would be really helpful, I'm free to change what I'm doing to make it appropriate. And so that iterative mindset is something that's really, really important. But it's a challenge. It says, evolve the design and respond to change versus minimization of rework. It's really a balancing act. You don't want to go too far down the road and then have to make changes.
Right. I'll give you an example from our teams. I'm on an iPhone team. We also have an Android team. We've both been in market now for about a year. And the team that Darrell is now working on is an iPad team. that's basically taking what we've done and putting it on an iPad.
And making it better.
And making it better, of course. But this team started out probably 9 months ago now, something like that. And this has been the most frequent demanded feature for our app, the iPhone app, is where is our iPad version? We want an iPad version. We bought this thing because we want to be able to go out into the field with it, and the phone is too small. And so this iPad team was formed, and the UX team for it was actually a committee, which designing by committee is a whole other thing. Don't even get me started. But they were demanding...
It wasn't me.
No, this was before Durrell's time. They were demanding that the paper prototypes, the click-through prototypes were not good enough. In order to do user testing, they needed fully implemented software that they could hand to a research subject on an iPad and have them actually use it on the iPad. Well, after a lot of arguing and fighting and bloodletting, they succumbed and they created this thing in just like production quality software, fully implemented the feature, and then it went to usability, and lo and behold, it didn't test well. And so they came back and again said, okay, well, here's a whole new design, and we want you to build it all out. And so, you know, they once again built it. They did this 3 times before they finally kind of gave up. 5 months. 5 months went by with no forward progress by that team. None whatsoever. It was all sideways, re-implementing the same thing over and over and over again. And that's when Durrell was brought in to fix that.
Nice, huh?
Yeah.
So I walked into that situation and what we're doing now is more about click-throughs that I can still test on the iPad, but no engineers are required, even though they've already spoken to me about how they might build it, right? We've all been involved in the shaping of that interaction, but no code has been written, and that's helped an awful lot. But I'm really still dealing with that legacy of, oh, you want to change something that's not working? It's already built. Are you sure? And I think it's really important for us to welcome change for the right reason. You know, if it's about the users, you want to make sure that it's going to work for our users and if it makes sense to change it. But there needs to be a good reason to do it. We're actually in the middle of that right now. One of the things that they spent 5 months working on is one of the major pieces of functionality in our app. And when I came on, I looked at it and I thought, oh my gosh, this main affordance is wrong. Basically, it's a text field for something that's actually a selection. And I made a fuss and I had to talk to my engineers who were very, very hesitant to make a change on this thing that they've been baking and working on. But I made the prototype and invited them to the test and said, look, do you see how everyone is able to do this? Boom, 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 boom. And I always use the, since I'm designing for the iPad and I'm right-handed, I use the can my big fat left finger do it test, and I can. So users had no problems using my prototype, and the team was convinced with a lot of discussion, talking about why, the rationale, why it's going to make sense, and because the way I finally designed it was it's a system, so they're able to componentize the pieces and reuse them throughout the rest of the app. So with a lot of communication and a lot of talking to our customers about what their needs are, we're able to iterate and change. This experience has also made me a better designer because, first of all, I have to be comfortable with change. You know, I didn't just work and work and work and make the perfect design. We're iterating on that design. And the first thing we make, even if it's just in a paper, might not work. And, you know, you really have to build on it. And I remember I started out as a print designer, which meant that I had real control over every aspect of that brochure or poster I was making, from the typography that I used, to the images that I used, to how it looked on press. And I have to give up a lot of that working on an app on a computer. You know, people may change how they look. They might try to make it bigger. They don't have the fonts. You know, there's all sorts of crazy things. So there has to be a comfort level with change that you have to be able to accept. And the other thing is that I say here more empathy. I think I have to have more empathy, not just with our users, but with our stakeholders, with our engineers, with the whole team. I really have to put myself in their mindset to understand and listen to what they're saying. And that helps me become a better designer. And I think being a better designer makes better products. It makes you more successful. I was once a manager for many years, actually, and I thought that as a manager, I would have more influence. That was the way to have more influence over products. But in fact, as a designer on these two different mobile teams, I have a huge amount of product influence. I'm the one saying, this is the most priority in the backlog that we should work on. And I'm the one saying, you know, we have to move this up or move this back, and this is how it's going to work. So I have a huge stake in how that product looks and works. And the better designer I am, the better that product is going to be. Agile makes you a better designer. And why? First of all, it's about the team, right? You need to be part of that team. You can't be separate. You can't work somewhere else. The closer you are to the team, the better. It's about making the process serve you, right? We said we changed the process. And by the way, we did a lot of things before we came up with the pre-planning meeting. We really worked it to make the process served us. And don't be afraid to speak up if things aren't working. I think a lot of people step back and say, oh, well, this is how it is, and it has to be a scrum, it has to be this way. It doesn't. I think this is my biggest point. A good idea is a good idea. It doesn't have to be just my idea. It's not about us and them. And welcome change, but for the right reason. And to understand what's going on, talk to your customers. You know, one of the things we do actually is that we're in an alpha, so our tablet app is not actually released yet. But if anyone's interested, I can show it to you. And we have about 50 users that are our posse that have access to the alpha. And we don't wait for them to give us feedback. We go out to them all the time and say, we're about to do this thing that you've been asking for. What do you think? And we're having that one-to-one conversation with people who are our target users before we actually are going to release this app. And it's really helped us think about what are their needs and how do we do that, as opposed to, it's not like we're guessing about their expectations because they're telling us. And that's it. Does anybody have any questions?
Hi, I'm Lindsay. I work at a startup in New York as a UX designer. I'm the only one, and there's 22 engineers. Wow. So when I see the, like, 2060, I'm like, wow, that'd be awesome.
Yeah.
I can't do that. I guess I'm wondering, you talk about the planning and pre-planning, and I do that very spontaneously, not orderly, as it seems like you guys may do. How far ahead of time are you planning out these projects, and how big are these projects that you're kind of doing all this planning for?
So our project is really, really big. It's an app called QuickBooks that is an accounting application on the desktop, and we're translating that. So it has a huge amount of features. So we're planning strategically ahead for a wide thing, but we're thinking short term, what are the user stories that we're solving for short term? But we do work in a big company, and there are big company goals that we have to meet. So it is a real balance. And you asked also about the 2060.
I guess I was just saying, like, when you're having a pre-planning meeting, are you planning for, like, this entire massive
time? It's just the upcoming sprint. Yeah, so we kind of do informal balancing of, okay, while we're doing pre-planning for this sprint, I'm thinking what's in the next sprint. You know, so I'm not two iterations ahead right now. I'm, like, on the current iteration, to be honest. So I'm just trying to get ahead. And so I understand your predicament, and the only thing I can tell you is try to make your engineers comfortable with ambiguity. So what is the level of fidelity that you need to design to get them moving? And then don't worry, and then sit down and talk to them about stuff rather than only have it on your artifacts. That's how I get to push myself ahead.
Hi. So I'm new to trying to work in something that I guess resembles an agile environment. And my question for you is around the team that isn't just the two of you. I'm curious about product management and project management, because that's something that seems to be important, particularly when being able to plan these multiple iterations ahead. So how is planning? How is coordination? Are you all sitting together? Are you all sitting separate? Like, how does the meta work happen that keeps these things moving forward?
Okay. So on my current team, there's me, There's a product manager, and he and I are joined at the hip, pretty much. I actually meet him informally every day. I sit on the same floor as the engineers, but not with them. And there are 9 engineers. And those are front end, and then there's 3 QAs. So I'm actually the only person. I'm trying to keep up with 9 engineers, pretty much. Yeah, it's crazy. We don't have project management. That's really where somebody like Mike comes in.
Yeah, so as far as project management goes, because we have an Android team, an iPhone team, an iPad team, and there's also a Mac team, all working on kind of the same thing with a lot of shared resources, so there's also a shared resources team. There's a program manager that kind of manages at a very high level all of the dependencies and interactions. But as far as the project management, that's really done largely by the team, the product owner, and the Scrum Master working together. Yes. So we have a tool that we use called Rally, and that's where all of our stories, user stories, are written and kept, and those stories are prioritized. So everybody can look at Rally and see what work is coming up next. But otherwise, that's pretty much the way we do it.
Actually, my tools haven't really changed. I still do user interviews. I still do user research. We still do ethnography and usability testing. The thing that's changed mostly is that I'm trying to do much, much more in person. I'm also trying to do much, much more sketching rather than jumping into high fidelity. But I don't know if that's an agile thing or an experience thing. I don't make specs like I used to. When you hand things over in Waterfall, everything has to be worked out in a spec, and you find out a year later that that's impossible to build. That doesn't happen. I make a spec document, but it's light. And most of the conversation about how that's actually going to work is side by side. And I also do, since I'm working on an interaction pad experience, I actually end up making what I call dirty prototypes to see how the transition might work, or to show somebody how I expect or how I would like that transition to work. And I might just mock that up, however, in Flash or Keynote or whatever I can do really fast to communicate with the team. Does that answer your question? So there are visual designers on our team. They're less hooked up right now with my current team, but they're very, very hooked up to me. We're actually redesigning the whole look and feel of the initial app. And so how it typically works is I'll sketch something out and show it to the visual designer, and we sit next to each other. And so we'll be talking, and that discussion will actually influence the sketch or the wireframe so that right away, their point of view is implemented into what I end up showing the engineers. And then as things get moving, the visual designers actually come to the stand-ups and are part of the team. So especially when it comes to, you know, you need to make a new piece of background art or an icon or whatever it is. Sometimes I play that role. I did play that role on the mobile team. There was a visual system that was already established. So I just mocked things up. There was no difference between what I did as a interaction designer. I was the designer.
Well, I guess my question more is, like, if you had your initial designs, how do you avoid that feeling that you were talking about earlier, which is common for engineers who are like, I didn't really have a say in it. So if you're sketching that up ahead of time and then working with the designer, how do they use their voice to be able to?
Oh, well, because I'm showing it to everybody. And so everybody's getting in on the conversation, not just the engineers, but the visual designer. And typically the visual designer will, as they're coming to stand up and they're talking, so their point of view is there as well. What we're doing right now to change the whole visual system is we're literally going on a education offensive of here is why we need to change this type of communication.
So Lindsay brought up a point about startup experience versus what sounds like you're going, in the Intuit example, from an established application and repurposing that for a tablet. And I think there's a significant difference, perhaps, between a startup versus maybe refactoring. And I'd like to know your feelings about the design visioning that needs to be done ahead of time, that UX planning, and the technical planning that need to work together, I think, to get to that common vision.
So we're not a startup by all means. Intuit is a huge company, and this app actually exists. But the tablet that I'm working on was actually thought of as a new thing. So we were actually encouraged to vision it as something new, and that we didn't have to follow all the existing conventions, and that we weren't going after all the existing users, and we didn't have to worry about that. And so that's the initial strategy, was around, let's see how we can shake this up. And rather than targeting accountants, we're gonna target small business owners. And then I came in, and of course, the goals changed. And so now we're still targeting a different user, and we're still saying that this is a new thing, but it has to work within an ecosystem. So there has to be some sort of relationship between my device, Mike's device, the web, and maybe the desktop. And we're calling them device differences for a reason. So everything has to have some sort of relationship, but it doesn't always have to be the same. And so one of the ways we thought about this strategy was there was a huge amount of ethnography done to figure out, wait, who are the users that we don't have, and how can we go after them? And I think that's one of the reasons we're going down this separate path.
It just quick follow-up. Is that something that takes 2 weeks? You know, we always hear in my organization a sprint zero. You know, you just give us a couple wireframes and then we'll start coding. I feel that's possible within a refactoring environment where you kind of know where it's going versus a startup where there's some upfront to define.
Oh no, our roadmap changes all the time. It used to be this, now it's this, now it's this. No. It doesn't matter where you are, that always changes. So, but I don't think you can do anything in 2 weeks for a strategy, which is why for conceptual work, I try to tell stories and not make a mock, but to sort of talk about what it is and what's the story around it and who's going to use it, as opposed to here is what I think it should be.
We're running into the break time. If you have additional questions, why don't we take them offline? Because I want to be sensitive to people's time and not chew up your break. But thank you very much for coming today.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from the 2012 IA Summit. The IA Summit podcast is sponsored by the UIE Virtual Seminar Program, with scores of online seminars your team can access on demand. For free access to a virtual seminar, visit uie.com/IAS12. And you can find the rest of the IA Summit podcast at library.iasummit.org.